later tonight or tomorrow morning. My name is Sam Bowman. You can catch us every other Tuesday at 5:30 p.m. here on KBOO 90.7 FM, your community radio station.
Thank you, Sam. You are listening to KBOO KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Next up is Transpositive.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Development Committee will meet the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices of a People's History, a movement of movements, on Wednesday, July 10th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Revolution Hall in Portland. Voices of a People's History celebrates diverse movement leaders by sharing their stories. Members of our community perform readings of notable speeches and essays from inspiring figures past and present, a radically empowering opportunity to hear the echoes of history in the present day. Again, that's Voices of a People's History, a movement of movements, on Wednesday, July 10th from 6 to 9 p.m. at Revolution Hall, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland, listener-powered, non-corporate community radio.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive PDX. My name is Emma and I use she and her pronouns.
My name is Jean Bryant and I also use she and her pronouns.
And we are here today with Dr. Karen Blair. Dr. Blair, would you like to introduce yourself?
I'm, as you said, Karen Blair. I also use she, her pronouns, and I'm an assistant professor of psychology at St. Francis Xavier University in Nova Scotia, Canada.
Thank you. So we're here today to talk to Dr. Blair. So first, Dr. Blair, tell us a little bit about, let's just start with some informalities. How's the weather in Canada today?
Oh, all of Canada? I can't. In my little corner of it, it's actually not too bad. The sun, well, it's kind of playing hide and seek. So in Nova Scotia, it can rain at any moment. And so right now it's not raining, and I'm hoping it'll stay that way for the day.
Well, we can completely relate to those kinds of circumstances here in Portland.
Yeah, it sounds like 9 months out of the year, it sounds like somebody from Nova Scotia would feel right at home in Portland.
I have a feeling that might be true.
The only thing about Portland that's a little different is we have volcanoes and we also have like 3 months of no rain, which I don't know if you have that in Nova Scotia.
I don't think we've ever had 3 months of no rain. Never.
Anyways, Dr. Blair, welcome to Transpositive. So we're here today. We wanted to talk to you about Dr. Blair. You recently had an article in Psychology Today, and it was addressing the issue of transgender folks and compatibility in terms of dating with a broad spectrum measure of the community that included people who were cisgender. It included people who were bisexual. It included people who identify as trans and non-binary. And it was kind of like asking, you know, some really broad questions, which I think a lot of us in the transgender community are really curious about. We're trying to find answers to, because this is all kind of a new and evolving conversation. We just wanted to talk to you about your article and see what we can learn from it. And also, you know, maybe some things that trans folks and cis folks can help educate each other about. So first we'd like to start with, could you just tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Yeah, so, where to begin? I said I was an assistant professor of psychology, and my specific area of psychology, I kind of carve out my own. I call it LGBTQ psychology, but I'm formally trained as a social psychologist, which means I study basically how humans interact with each other, and how our thoughts and feelings fluctuate within certain social situations. And in particular, I study relationships. And my biggest area of research actually looks at how if you feel that your relationship that you're in is socially supported by your friends and your family, then we find that you tend to report being in a happier relationship. And not only that, you report fewer mental and physical health concerns. So that's kind of one of my big areas of research. But I suppose one of my more unique takes in how I approach my research is that I'm always doing LGBTQ inclusive research. So whatever it is that I'm studying, I want to make sure that LGBTQ people are included as participants, and so that we can learn about everybody's relationships. Because, I mean, when I was an undergrad, I took this course on close relationships, and the whole thing was about heterosexual relationships. And any time I had a question where I was like, what if this is a same-sex relationship, they had no answers to give me. And even today, I always say, you know, we've gotten a little bit better in being able to answer those questions now, but we haven't really gone very far if people say, oh, what if it's a gender-diverse relationship? What if there's a trans or non-binary person in the relationship? How does it work then? And really, the literature is empty. There's very little out there. And so that's kind of just really important to whatever it is that I'm studying. I want to make sure it's going to speak to as many people as possible. It's not always possible to kind of answer it for everyone, but as many as I can.
Go ahead, Jean.
One of the general truths, I mean, there is absolutely and has been a dearth of research. A lot of that has to do with the fact that nobody could get funding to do research into our community. Are you finding that to be a challenge? I mean, how are you approaching the scope of your studies at this point? Are you actually able to get some funding and support for this? Or are you doing some of this work kind of just winging it?
That's a really excellent question. And it's definitely, there has been improvements over time. So I've been doing this for more than a decade. And it has ebbed and flowed with the political scene in terms of whether or not funding was available. I think that because I try, with lots of my research, I try to approach a larger question. So does social support for a relationship impact relationship well-being? So I can get funding to do that research and then do it in an inclusive way that allows me to carve out sub-questions that are specific to the LGBTQ community. So that's one way of getting that money, kind of just tagging it on to larger issues. I've also had lots of success with kind of specific agencies. So there's the Lesbian Health Fund from the Gay and Lesbian Medical Association that's been supportive of my work, the American Institute of Bisexuality. And then at times, though, I've actually turned to crowdfunding. So one of my studies was entirely supported by just members of the public who were, it was a study on hate crimes, and so they were just interested in supporting that work, and so we've done it that way. We have a patron page that allows people to support us that way as well. So, you know, like, we do fairly well with getting funding, but, I mean, it is always something that is tricky, and I think we also have a little bit better of a funding structure in Canada when it comes to being open to funding LGBTQ research. We don't seem to have as much as many barriers there, I don't think.
Oh, there you Canadians go, just bragging again about your healthcare system, about your higher education system, and about your all that stuff. We're just so braggy Canadians.
Yeah, well, believe me, we're envious.
But we have our president. God bless America.
Yes.
That's great. I'm so happy to hear that. So can you tell us a little bit about your background too? Like, how did you get into this kind of work? What led you to do social, what is it called, like social psychology research, or what's your field specifically?
It is in social psychology. So that's kind of what you would call it. And I guess, well, all through my undergrad, I actually thought that I wanted to be a forensic psychologist, which meant that I would have been working in the criminal justice system. And then I took that course that I mentioned on close relationships, and I found that area of research so fascinating that I decided I would study relationships instead. And at the same time, I was early 20s or something at the end of my undergrad. So I was also coming to terms and figuring out my own sexual identity at that time. So it was extra interesting to me asking these questions about same-sex relationships and realizing that there were no answers. And I always tell a story about going to Pride in Toronto in 2003, which is actually happening today as Pride in Toronto right
Yay,
now.
Yay, happy Pride.
Sing it, yeah, but happy Pride. But anyways, I was at Pride, and you know when P flag goes by in any Pride parade, and it kind of changes from that kind of everyone's happy and dancing and screaming and having fun and all of that kind of noise, and then when P flag marches by, the parents and friends of lesbians and gays, but I think now they're more inclusive. Anyways, when they go by, it changes and people start clapping, and it's more of like this sound of gratitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Really struck me that first year that I was there, because I had no idea. I didn't know what PFLAG was. I didn't know anything about it. And what struck me was, like, this was social support. It was people marching, not necessarily for their own kids and friends, but for all the ones whose parents weren't marching. And it was this kind of just overwhelming outpour of social support, and you could just see, like, if you look across the parade route, right, and you find someone in the crowd, when PFLAG goes by, you'll find someone crying, or you'll find many people crying. And it's so, like, that amount, you could instantly see what that social support meant to the LGBTQ community. And especially you got that sense of it was meaning so much because for so many that social support was missing. And it was that was kind of my aha moment in terms of research. It was like, okay, how do I put these things together? How do I actually measure what the impact of, essentially, what is the impact of a PFLAG group marching by, but kind of in more broader research terms, what is the impact of having social support for a marginalized identity, a marginalized relationship? And so that's where I got started. And I've just kind of followed that through wherever it's led me since.
That's great. Well, so your study that you did recently that was in Psychology Today, let's talk about that a little bit. That was a pretty broad study. I read that you had about 1,000 people that you interviewed. Can you tell us a little bit about how did you come to approach this study, and how was it conducted?
Yeah, so this is a kind of back to your funding question about how do I get money to do this research. I'm not sure if I... So what the study, the paper that I, or the article I wrote for Psychology Today is about a journal article that looks at patterns of excluding trans people from our hypothetical dating world, essentially. And in terms of, so how you asked me about funding, this paper, I never asked anybody to fund this particular research question. It came out of a larger study where we were looking at hypothetical dating decisions. And so it was, again, back to that social support idea. We would say to people, okay, imagine that you've been dating someone for 6 months. You really, really like them. You think they're great. You bring them home to your parents, and your parents say, oh my, no, this is definitely not right. This relationship's not good. You need to break up with them. You need to end this right away. And that's kind of the scenario we would give to people. And then we said, what would you do? Would you actually just break up with them? Would you consider what they were saying and feel a little more uneasy about the relationship? Or would you completely discount whatever they said and said, no, like, this is none of your business. I'm dating who I want to date. And that's essentially, that was what the study was about. We wanted to see who would say what. And in general, one of the things that we found is that if people were reporting on a mixed-sex relationship, they were much more likely to say that they would consider that advice from their parents or friends. But if it was some kind of a marginalized relationship, they were much less likely, because I think they were responding, even in this hypothetical scenario, they're saying, oh, well, you know what, I think maybe your disapproval is based on the type of relationship I'm in and not the qualities of the relationship itself. So that was the broader study, but in order to send our participants, this is like done online in an online survey, so in order to send them to the right questions, we had to know who would you ever possibly hypothetically date in the future. Because we wanted to be able to see, for example, if you had a bisexual person, we wanted to know, would they respond differently based on being in a same-sex or a mixed-sex relationship? So because of that, we said, who would you ever possibly date in the future if you were ever looking for a partner? And so we included cisgender men, cisgender women, transgender men, transgender women. And in the original version of the study, we said genderqueer, which I think now we've redone it and we would say non-binary today, but when we were first collecting data, genderqueer was kind of the more in term of the day. And so those were the options that we gave people, and it was really just intended to get them to the other parts of the survey. But when we went back and we looked at it, we're like, you know, there's actually an interesting story just to tell in people's responses to this single question. And that's what this paper was based on.
Go ahead. I think Jean has a question.
Okay.
Yes, Dr. Blair. This was done online. Is the population sampled exclusively Canadian? Was it just North America? Was it worldwide? What was the scope of the population sampled?
Yeah, so it wasn't limited to North America, but we did have, I'm not sure if I have the numbers right in front of me. Let me see, 76% lived in Canada and 19% lived in the United States. So it is largely a North American sample, but we didn't have any kind of restrictions on that. But it is also favored to the Canadians. You can't by any means call this a representative sample. We weren't doing any kind of, sampling methods that would give us a nationally representative sort of sample. But on the other hand, one of the things I do find really interesting about our sample is that this was just it was billed as a study on dating decisions, right? How do you make decisions about your dating life? It didn't really, in the recruitment or anything like that, and even in participating in the study, other than a few questions that allowed people to inclusively identify themselves, there wasn't a lot in the study that was kind of LGBTQ-specific. It was just LGBTQ-inclusive. So I think...
Which is great. I mean, it's so... Yeah. Like, we're still not being included in all kinds of studies like this, so it's great just to even do that.
Yeah, so and that's what we try to do with all of our studies. And so as a result, I think it's kind of the best of both worlds. Anyone could participate, but I think, it wasn't ringing bells for someone saying, oh, I shouldn't be in this study. This is all about LGBTQ stuff. So as a result, when it comes down to this question we ended up looking at, it's definitely not a representative sample, but it's not some sort of really weird sample either. It does give us some insight into what maybe the general population might think. It can't be a perfect metric for it, but it's not too skewed horribly.
And I mean, what an issue. I feel like I'm going to kind of go to some of my endpoints, but just even though we're just at the beginning of our conversation, but I feel like one of the things that the study shows right away is it shows that when you talk about like really high rates of attempts at suicide and self-harm, that is very common in the transgender community that, like your study, helps to provide a material basis for explaining the chain of actions that like lead to that state. I think a lot of times there's this assumption that people who are transgender are mentally ill, and that's why they try to commit suicide at such a high rate, or they have problems with drug addiction or whatever they have problems with. And this really shows, I think, within the broader context, that like a really healthy sense of self-esteem comes from like broad general support, like from your family, from your community, from your peers. And that when those supports are taken away and you're isolated, then it can lead to really challenging circumstances for individuals to thrive in. And so I think that this provides a chain of evidence that helps us really look and have some empathy for people who are in that state.
I think you're absolutely, absolutely right. I think that's, to me, that's what this kind of shows. It's the big question going with social support is we get so much of that social support in our life from a partner. We might all have different numbers of partners throughout our lifetime and different numbers of partners even at once, but our partners provide us with a huge source of support throughout our lifetime. And if you take that away, like anyone out there listening can just think about the importance of the relationships they've had to their life and their well-being. And if you were to take that away and say, you can't have that, you know, who would you have turned to in all of those moments of your life where you were experiencing stress or even when you're experiencing joy, right? Things are not as joyful when you have no one to share them with. And so I think, you know, I don't want to take this is such a, you know, I don't want to tell young trans people out there listening either that no one's going to date you and that this won't be possible. I don't think that's true either. But at the same time, I want to tell other people, you know, if we're really going to include people, that needs to include the people that are closest to us as well. And dating is part of that. And I think you're absolutely right that it does provide a stepping stone in providing explanations for why we do see some severe mental health disparities. It's not something coming from within. It's a product of living in a society that fundamentally is excluding you.
Yeah, dating is a huge part of it for sure. Jean, did you have a question? Maybe in a minute.
Yeah, maybe in a minute.
Okay. So can you tell us, did your study help explain cisgender ideas about transgender dating suitability? So what I'm trying to get at with this question is, when you looked at your study, when you helped to craft your study, one of the things that it did was it created boxes or windows. So I mean, I have to be honest, first of all, just as a transgender woman, I don't really identify as transgender or female. I'm just a woman. And so like for me, if I was taking your survey, I probably wouldn't have checked off a box that's like distinguished myself from any other woman, because it's like, for me, that's what I am. I'm a woman. And I mean, I live as a woman. I'm legally a woman. I look like a woman. I don't necessarily sound like a woman, but there's really nothing I can do about my voice. But besides that, I basically live like a woman. And so I would just consider myself a woman. I wouldn't necessarily consider myself, for the purpose of your survey, transgender. But there's a lot of people who will self-identify as transgender. And what I'm wondering is, does your survey help explain or does it give any insight into the kind of perspective that cisgender people, and we need to, let's identify cisgender first. Karen, could you talk about the term cisgender, or would you like me to do that?
You can do that. That's fine.
Sure. Yeah, cisgender is just a term. It was kind of created within the transgender community as a way of like helping to distinguish between people who identify as transgender and the rest of the community, people who are basically born natally, who were identified by the general culture as being natally a gender that was assigned to them. So like if you were born and you were assigned female and people think that you're female and you look female, that's cisgender. If you were born female but somebody said you're male because they looked at your anatomy and they said you're male and then you had to like transition to female, that's transgender. So anyways, but does your survey give any insight into how cisgender people kind of look at transgender people for dating suitability?
So I want to talk about the first thing you mentioned as well, about how you would have responded on the survey, and then I'll answer that. Because we actually did, when the survey was live, we did get a lot of emails from people saying, why are you asking me to differentiate a woman is a woman, a man is a man? And we would, you know, we were like, well, we absolutely agree with that. However, like, the end results of the survey clearly say that from the outside, other people don't always agree with that. And whenever we ask people, often what we'll do is when we're asking people's own demographics, we will say something like, what's your gender? Man, woman, not listed, please tell us more. And then we'll ask another question to identify trans versus cis status, if that's relevant to the study. And we kind of hope that that might be the place where someone would then identify that, so that they can identify as their gender as it is, and then give us more information about whether or not their gender has changed since they were born, just as a way to try and to get at that. I think researchers are still, every day someone's coming up with a new way of measuring better and getting people to let us know, because sometimes you really do want to know that information if you're trying to better understand health and well-being in a particular subgroup. But anyway, so I think with most of our sample, the way we worded the questions, people would have probably identified, but there's definitely the possibility that in some cases they wouldn't have. And then when we were asking people who they would date, we provided definitions, because we also knew that not everyone would know what does cisgender mean and what does transgender mean. So we provided those definitions. As to your other question about, do we get any insight from what cisgender people are thinking about trans people? Not from the first study, not from the published study that's in the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships. That study just looks, all we had was, who would you date? Hypothetically, if you were ever dating someone again, who would you date? And then we just looked at their demographics to see how the people who said that they would date trans people differed from the people who said that they wouldn't. But as a result of that study, we've done a follow-up study, but it's not published yet. We've presented it at the Canadian Psychological Association just a couple weeks ago. And in that study, what we did was we asked the same question again early in the survey, and then later on near the end of the survey, we said, you know, earlier you said that you would or wouldn't date a certain gender. Could you tell us more about your reasoning? Could you tell us your reasons? And what we did, that's where we're starting to get some insight into what are the kind of thought processes that people are going through. And we're still working with the data, and we have more to go through in terms of analyzing it, because again, we have, I think this time we have maybe 2,000 responses, and now we have open-ended responses where people are typing us long answers about their reasons, so that takes a long time to go through and fully kind of analyze. But from what we've gone through so far, we've kind of seen a few different categories. There's outright prejudice, right? And I don't think that's going to come as a shock.
Really? There's prejudice? I can't believe it. It must be a Canadian thing.
And, you know, they pay me. And so, yeah, so a lot of the answers really are, they're prejudicial answers. They use dehumanizing language. There's quite a few articles going around right now on the internet that are kind of twisting what I wrote in the Psychology Today article. And they're saying that I claimed that cisgender people dehumanize trans people by not dating them. Now, that's something you could debate, but that's not actually what the article said. What I said was that many people, when asked to describe why won't you date a trans person, they use dehumanizing language. So they say, I don't want to date people who are non-human. I don't date ghosts, I don't date spirits, and I don't date people with make-believe genders.
Yes, we've heard all of these, yes. And it's good that that's, you know, put into us, into a study, so that it's really shown clearly that, you know, this is the kind of prejudice that we're facing right now, so.
Exactly. Yeah. And with our first paper, I mean, I remember when we were writing the kind of discussion section of the paper, we were being so careful with what we were saying, because, you know, we wanted people to hear what we were saying, but we only had the answer. We didn't have any reasons. So we really didn't have anything we could use to say these people are all prejudiced, right? We couldn't actually support that kind of a statement. We didn't know what their reasons were, but we could guess, right? And so we were kind of trying to be very, you know, I guess, diplomatic. But the response to that paper has just been kind of so, heated, that the prejudice is right. It's not lurking under the surface. It's a prejudice that people are still very much willing to just outwardly express.
Yeah, including killing transgender people. That's just, exactly. Or beating them up and assaulting them. These are just expressions of that same prejudice, just in words.
And so that's definitely a big part of it in the second study, seeing that. There are other parts, though. And one of the things that I actually found kind of hopeful, I suppose, was that there's a lot of people writing things like, well, when you just asked me who I would date, I just went with, you know, what I'm used to saying. So I said I would date cisgender men, or I said I would date cisgender women. But now that you're asking me why won't I date a trans person, I'm realizing I don't actually have a good answer. I don't really know why I said that. I guess it's something I need to learn more about. I don't know what it would really mean for me in a relationship. And so I guess I'd have to learn more. So they're kind of, once they're actually asked, they begin to kind of be like, oh, I guess I need to think about this more. And I kind of hope that maybe some of them walked away and did keep thinking about it more, and whatnot. Other people had pretty specific kind of requests for information, kind of like, well, I don't know what that would mean for me. Like, I'm attracted to this, and so I don't know if a trans woman would be that or if a trans man would be that. And so kind of, I think there's a lot of, I mean, if you look at the bathroom wars, right, that are taking place, again, I'm not to pick on you guys, but largely in the U.S.
North Carolina.
Right? And they really play on that man in a dress trope that's deceptive and sneaking up on you and going into some place where they shouldn't be. And that's just so, it's not properly explaining to people what it means to be a trans woman who just wants to pee where they should. And so I think you can detect a lot of that kind of misinformation in people's responses, that they just don't know what it means. And I do think it is, you were mentioning early on about kind of what can trans people teach cis people and what can cis people kind of learn and things like that, and what can we learn from each other, so to speak. And I think one of them is, I know that one of the big things that comes down is, like, you know, you can't reduce a person to their genitals, and that we certainly don't go around introducing ourselves with our genitals. You know, dogs.
I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, just whip it out. You might get a ticket. But because of that, and I perfectly agree that those are providing the right sentiments in terms of focusing a person and their personality first. But I do also think that it creates this era of mysticism where a lot of people just have no idea. And if you think about it, where would they get this information, right? If Google Image is probably not the place to go, we're not talking about it in school. It's not even really covered very well in LGBTQ health education for doctors. So I think there's such a void of information that people feel that they don't have the information to make such a decision. I still think you can argue that shouldn't it always just be the person? Shouldn't it always just be a person, you know, that we're seeing someone as human and as a person, we're going to evaluate their personality and whether or not we're attracted and all of those things. But I think for a lot of people, it is something that is tied to bodies, and they don't even know how to imagine what the possibilities will be, and just providing people with some facts there might actually go a long way. And then the other category, there was a category where people, you know, are bringing up concerns about reproduction. You know, like, oh, but I want to be with someone that I can have biological kids with. And one of our reviewers brought that up, so we actually included it in the paper as well. We hadn't even thought of it ourselves, actually. But
yeah, I mean, everybody knows that's why lesbians shouldn't get married because they can't have children, and gay men shouldn't get married because they can't have children, and transgender people shouldn't get married because they can't have children, right? Because obviously none of these categories can have children, right? Obviously that's not true because we all have children.
True for same-sex couples. But I also, I mean, look at dating profiles. There's no question about how fertile are you, right? We're not basing our attraction on these pieces of information. And often we date people for a long time before we find out that they're infertile for one reason or another. And then looking exclusively at mixed-sex couples, there's a huge, like, billion-dollar industry around infertility because couples stay together. They say, no, I want to stay with my partner and I want to do everything that we can to try and have a biological child. And if we can't, then, you know, they turn to other options like surrogacy and adoption and all of these. Like, this whole industry exists because of mixed sex relationships that are infertile.
Oh, there you go. You're using facts. You're making comparisons. We can't have any of that, especially in studies.
Yeah, it just seems, therefore, disingenuous to say, oh, no, I'm writing them off right away because we can't have kids.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Right? Like, you don't know that about the other people you're dating either.
Like, most of the transgender people I know have kids.
Exactly. And, I mean, it also doesn't help explain where you have people within the LGBT community who are saying, no, I won't date them because I want kids. That makes no sense. Because, you know, if you're a cis woman dating a cis woman, you're not having a biological kid, right? There's things you can do. You can, you know, get family members involved, and you can do all sorts of things. You can carry each other's eggs. But, you know, as of yet, outside of animals, they are not creating human babies out of two eggs or two sperm.
Right, but they have, like, they have a relationship that is just as deep and as meaningful, and oftentimes, like, much better than most heterosexual relationships I know.
Well, and we also know that, like, some trans people save, you know, they before transitioning might freeze their sperm or their eggs. And so within a same-sex relationship in the future, they actually do have the option of a biological child if that's something that's really important. And so, like, I just feel like it's a bit of a cop-out answer. Like, yes, those things matter to us, but clearly humans are adaptive in finding ways to become parents. And so it just doesn't seem like the thing that we're leading with the rest of the time. So why is it the thing we're leading with now?
And there's also, like, almost, like, here in Oregon, there's about 10,000 kids in our foster care system who all need and deserve loving parents. So there's lots and lots of options for people who want to have kids.
The other day, I think it said something like there are more same-sex couples in the United States wanting to adopt than there are children in all of the foster care systems in the United States. Like,
but thank God we have a president who's going to make sure that will never happen.
Yeah, and so, you know, but anyway, so in terms of your
God
general
bless America.
Insights, the insights are that, yes, there's still very high levels of prejudice out there. People also just lack information. I think I live in a bubble, right? I study LGBTQ stuff. I have LGBTQ friends. I am LGBT, like, all of that, right? So I sometimes forget how little information there would be to access beyond my world that I study so intensely. And so a lot of people really don't have that information, and, you know, they're not motivated to go seek it. So I do, like, I used the word education in the first draft of that article, and a lot of people got really upset that I was saying I wanted to brainwash people through education or something. But really, what I mean is I want there to be greater knowledge and greater understanding. And I think that those two things, you know, would play a key role in breaking down prejudice of all types, and especially trans prejudice.
Jean, did you have a question?
I have a cold, and so I'm struggling with my voice here. So I'd like to revisit a little bit that, you know, when you talk about education and some of the prejudices and assumptions and these images that we assume much of the general population, you know, have about trans folks, I think that it would be a huge influence in how someone would respond to the general question of would you date a trans person when we have no way of really distinguishing what that trans person's physiological status might be. And that, you know, I think it's a given that for most folks out there in the world, you know, it makes a difference what's down there.
Yes.
So with the, you know, again, you know, it's kind of like you were speaking about, you know, living in the bubble, and I do too. You know, I know that it is simply not politically correct for me to ever question, you know, someone's gender identity based on their genitals. I know that. But, you know, out in the world, it does make a difference. So, you know, how are we going to do that and do it in a, you know, to do some research? How are you going to do that without kind of breaking that politically correct barrier?
That's a challenge, right? But I think, I mean, one of our next studies that we have planned. So now the first one was just this kind of statistic. How many people won't date trans people, even hypothetically? The second study, we asked people to tell us why, so that we have their own words as to why. The third study, we haven't done this yet, but what we want to do next is we want to say, okay, if one of these things that popped out here was this lack of knowledge, a need for some kind of education, then if we give people kind of a little knowledge test on trans identities and what that means, then when people have higher knowledge, do we see higher inclusion?
Yeah.
That's one question.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's because then that can point to maybe that could make a difference. Another area, of course, that we want to do, like this just kind of begs for, is there some kind of, you know, I don't want to, like, we call them intervention studies, but it kind of makes that sound like those TV shows where people do interventions, and that's not what we mean. But is there some kind of, you know, piece of educational experience that we can provide that would then actually show a difference in people's responses? We have one, I participated in one study where we, students in a classroom, they watched a video about trans identities, and then there was a trans speaker who came into the class and spoke and just talked about their own life and things like that. And just those two things, that small amount of exposure and humanizing of a real person's story, reduced the people's prejudice within that class.
Uh-huh.
And I really do think that that's largely what a lot of this comes down to, is having those personal experiences with people where you realize, you know, it's the power of one person is actually quite fascinating. You know, we can give you all the statistics in the world, and we can tell you prejudice is bad for people's health. Even the prejudiced people, their health suffers as a result of being prejudiced. We can go at it from all sorts of angles like that, and none of that really compares to that experience that you have with one person, where you get to know that one person's story, and then that changes your perspective on that person and other people like them. And so I think that's partially the key. Is there ways that we can incorporate that kind of experience into an education or research setting to try and spread that further? The trick is, you know, I mean, one, sometimes we get that from rare positive media representations. That's a really important part of media representation, but so often those can be kind of flawed, that it's not doing that kind of a job. But in other cases, the question is, you know, that's asking a lot of individual people who are already facing a lot of other challenges. And so we can't just say, you know, to every trans person out there, go knock on a stranger's door and tell them your story. Like, that's unfair. And it's...
I'll do it.
Dangerous, I know. But it, ultimately, I mean, there is actually even a study where people did that, and that worked too. So it's kind of... I'm reminded of the, I mean, I wasn't alive, but I'm reminded of learning of the kind of the 60s and the 70s where they were, you know, just talking to the gays and the lesbians saying, come out wherever you are. The world will never accept us until they know that they already accept us, right? Until they know that they already love us because we're their kid, their coworker, their neighbor. They're never going to put two and two together. I don't know if we're at that same stage here.
Pretty close.
Or not.
Pretty close, yep. We're pretty close. We're not quite in the Mattachine era of, like, transgender rights, because, I mean, we are visible, but, you know, we probably are where the, like, the gay-lesbian movement was, like, maybe in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're not, like, I mean, I know that, like, LGBTQIAP++ is like kind of our moniker, but I mean, we're kind of coming along at different paces, and we also come along at different paces based upon, you know, racism too. I mean, we have to acknowledge that, like, you know, a lot of these conversations are absent of like looking at the devastating impacts of white privilege and how white privilege like affects these communities. You know, like in your study, I don't know if you address the issue of race, but I mean, I think it's really important to have an intersectional framework with like everything that we're doing. And so when we're looking at these issues, we also have to look at how prejudice, not just against trans people, but also specifically against trans people of color, plays out, how that's a real factor in, you know, what in educating people, because we need to educate people not just about prejudices that might have based on sexual orientation and gender identity, but we also need to look at, you know, the thing that really undergirds all of like Western European culture, which is racism.
Yeah. No, I mean, and I mean, our study, our sample was predominantly white. And so we couldn't get into dividing to see how much of a difference their own race made. And then we didn't present them with, you know, would you date a trans woman of color? We didn't get into that kind of minuteness in terms of answering the questions. But we do talk about it in the discussion because we do see that impact of intersectional identities. And we know that trans women of color are the most in danger in terms of facing violence. When we look at the Trans Day of Remembrance, it's always a long, long list of trans women of color. And so those factors are playing an important role. And with all that we do, kind of looking at all of the socioeconomic status, pulling in all of these elements of difference and trying to see, you know, you just can't, one person's experience, you know, doesn't add up to everybody else's. And I mean, I think sometimes it gets really kind of almost overwhelming because, you know, how will we combat all of these issues together? We're dealing with things that, you know, they've been dealing with for hundreds of years, and sometimes it's disappointing to see the lack of progress that's been made. One person emailed me about the article, and because in the article I make the point that one of the reasons that we thought this was useful to track, you know, how many people are willing to include trans people as a partner. And one of the arguments that we kind of pointed out was that sociologists have been following the same thing in terms of how accepting are people of interracial relationships. And usually the question they use, they'll say, if your son or daughter was in an interracial relationship, how would you feel about that? And they've been tracking that for decades, and it's been steadily increasing. You know, like if you go back to the 50s.
Can anyone say Barack Obama?
Nobody said that. No.
I can. Like, it's gone a long way. It's gone all the way to the presidency of the United States.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, like it goes all that way, but now we're maybe seeing a backlash. But, you know, like we've seen huge improvements in terms of that metric of accepting interracial relationships. It's gone up, you know, significantly. And the idea then is, can we track the same type of thing with trans people? When we see those numbers go up of willing to date them, then I think we could confidently say that they truly, you know, are being accepted in our society as a whole. But anyways, one person emailed me and they said, well, that argument, that doesn't really work because people really shouldn't be dating outside of their race. Oh, so now you're just...
Oh boy, that sounds like something somebody like rural Oregon would say.
Yeah, and so
sorry, rural Oregonians, I didn't mean that.
Yeah, and so I was, like, in that moment, I was just, like, I was kind of so defeated, because I was like, oh, like, the argument that I'm using, that I'm expecting everyone to be like, oh, yeah, totally, that's wrong, they're not even there yet. They're still saying, nope, that's just fine. And so, you know, sometimes we're not nearly as far on any of these issues as we think we are, and when we put them together, you know, we have a long, long way to go.
You know, I just wanted to interject here that it seems logical to me that if we used that response as the gauge for general acceptance into society or by the broader society, it's the most extreme measure we could use. I'm not sure it would be really reflective of the acceptance level. You know, I think as we look at ourselves, not, you know, just exclusively as the trans sub community, broader LGB, you know, population has really kind of gained a lot more general social acceptance that doesn't mean that the general population would necessarily want to
be their neighbor.
Well, no, they may be perfectly happy, you know, having, you know, a lesbian couple next door and get along great, party together. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that they're not, you know, cishet folks. So, you know, I'm just like, where... Anyway.
It is extreme, I agree. But I guess the point is that if you reached that level, you know, where everyone was okay with their son or daughter being in a same-sex relationship, interracial relationship, or dating a trans,
yeah.
Or if everyone was kind of like, yeah, I date men, so bring on the men, however they identify.
Yeah.
Bring on the men. Yeah.
That extreme stage.
Yeah.
Be kind of saying, well, I guess, you know, people are very included. I think there's definitely other important ways of measuring inclusion, and there's, you know, we're going to be satisfied with other kind of variations, but yeah. That extreme level, it gives you something to track over time. I mean, we're not at 100% acceptance of interracial relationships. We're not at a...
yeah, obviously.
Right. No, I get it, and it's, you know, I wasn't critiquing Dr. Blair. I was, you know, just making an observation there, but...
Yeah,
so,
yeah, no, totally.
So we've got, we've only got 6 minutes left in the show. I forgot. Okay, so first of all, I forgot to do the station ID. I need to do that right now. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM here in Portland, Oregon, and this is Transpositive. So, Dr. Blair, we've got about 5 minutes left in the program. Are there any points that we haven't addressed from your study that you'd like to make sure to highlight before we get to the end of the show?
Oh, good question. I think maybe one of the takeaways from this paper, I want to make it really clear, because one of the things that people have kind of been a little upset about with the paper is that they feel like we're saying that we're taking away their autonomy and who they get to date or who they are attracted to. And that's not what this paper is about. This paper is simply tracking at the societal level what are the patterns in how people answer this question of who they will consider dating and who they won't. At the end of the day, everybody does have that full autonomy in terms of choosing the individuals that they date. And by and large, it's true that, you know, we can't tell who ourselves who to be attracted to. Otherwise, you know, we'd avoid some really bad relationships if we could say, oh, that guy's really hot, but he's bad news.
Yeah.
that doesn't work. And so we do have to give space for that. You know, you have autonomy. You, at the end of the day, get to decide who you date, how you date them, what you do with them, all of those things. That doesn't mean that we can't learn from looking at the broader societal patterns of who's being included and who's being excluded. They can be two separate things. And I guess I would just say to someone who feels maybe a little uneasy about what they're hearing is, you know, maybe just give that some more thought. What are your reasons? What do you know and what don't you know about what it would be like to date a trans woman or a trans man based on, you know, whether you're interested in men or women or both? And give that some thought and, you know, just wonder what that would be like to know that simply because of one aspect of your identity, the vast majority of the world was just writing you off as someone to be dated. And I think that's, you know, when you put it that way, I was able to speak with one man in Australia who, you know, didn't agree with a lot of what I had to say, but the end conclusion that we came to was that every human deserves human dignity and every human deserves to be loved and to have that opportunity to form close, intimate relationships, and no one should be written off by some aspect of their identity before we even get to know who they are, before we know their name, their history, their story. And I think, I really enjoyed that conversation that I had with this man from Australia, because as much as we started at complete opposite ends of the topic, we did find some common ground. And I think that common ground, if we can't find that on some of the most challenging topics, then we really are headed to some dark places. So wherever we can find that common ground, I think it's really important. And I think that starts with each of us just kind of sitting with ourselves and thinking about these questions and giving it some more thought about why we would do what we would and why we wouldn't do what we would.
And I think not just, I mean, not just asking those questions, but I think, and I mean, not just asking those questions and sitting and thinking about them, but I think that so many parts of your study help me see the need for real education, that people need to know about body parts. People need to know about bodies, because it's like, I mean, people just don't understand what a transgender body even is. Or how, you know, I mean, our transgender bodies are fabulous. And
you already are, right?
Uh-huh.
Not just take a deficit approach. Like, what are the benefits? What are the perks? What are the, you know, I know so many, you know, people who they start out in a relationship and they didn't know, then the trans person comes out to them and then they end up, you know, it ends up being something that's actually very cherished in the relationship. And I just don't think we even know that when we don't have that information at the beginning.
Oh, totally. Yeah, that's so true. Like, I think that every transgender person I know has got so many anecdotes that would, like, you know, tail on the end of what you just said so well. Yeah, so, well, we've just got a couple of minutes left. That we really appreciate having you on, Dr. Blair. So what's coming up in the future for you?
Well, let's see. We're going to keep looking at this data, and we keep studying it, and just kind of, we just let the data drive what the next question will be, and then we'll ask the next question. We'd have a whole other area of research where we study hate crimes.
Mm.
And, you know, like, that's another area. Like, so we did a study on the response to the Pulse shooting.
Mm-hmm.
We study predictors of anti-gay hate crimes, and looking at a lot of stuff to do with public displays of affection.
Wow, thanks. If people want to find out more about you, Dr. Blair, or your work, is there a way that they can contact you?
Yes. So my website is drkarenblair.com, and they can find everything that they need to there. We've got our patron page connected to there. We've got all our journal articles are available. If there's ever an article that's not on the website, people are more than welcome to email me for a PDF. I'm happy to share our research.
And that's Dr. Is that drkarenblair.com? Dr. Karen Blair?
Yeah, just the short form.
Okay, great. Dr. Blair, thank you so much for joining us here in Transpositive Gene. Do you want to?
Yes, I just wanted to say thank you. It's been such a pleasure having you, and I look forward to having you back again in the not too distant future.
Yeah, it's clearly not hard for us to fill an hour.
Yeah, I didn't even get to like 90% of my questions. So thank you so much for being with us on the show tonight, and enjoy the weather on Nova Scotia, eh?
Yeah. Oh, God. I'm going to go for a bike ride.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. One, two, three.
Chan chan le daba pena.
You're listening to KBOO KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. We just heard Transpositive with Emma and Jean, and next up is Calculated Conversation with David and Ken.
Tune in to KBOO on July 4th through the 7th for our live broadcast from the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival. We'll start the broadcast from the Waterfront Blues Festival on Thursday, July 4th at noon, and broadcast the fest every day from noon through 10 p.m. Again, that's the Waterfront Blues Festival, the largest celebration of blues, soul, funk, and rhythm and blues west of the Mississippi, July 4th through the 7th from noon to 10 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Storytime with Book Signing with Tanya Lippert on Saturday, July 6th at 1 p.m. at Books Around the Corner in Gresham. Tanya Lippert is releasing the book Goodbye School, where the main character